Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, May 27th, 2025. We begin on the front page with Council to Decide $36 Million Bond by Drew Zimmerman. When it meets Tuesday, the Bloomington City Council will consider issuing $36 million in general obligation bonds to finance future water projects, with the possibility of another $72.5 million being executed in fiscal 2027. In November 2023, the City Council voted to more than double its current water rates to help invest more than $350 million in Bloomington's water system, including infrastructure updates and the replacement of lead service lines. For residents with the most common size of residential water pipe, who use roughly 3,000 gallons of water per month, their monthly water bill is expected to be about $40 in fiscal 2027, compared to $17 when the rate increase was first approved. However, $172 million in capital projects are estimated in the next 5 years, much of which would be covered by bonds, according to city documents. The initial $36 million bond request would be structured to net about $33 million to the city's water fund. This is estimated to cover about 18 months of projects. Timelines will be reevaluated as work progresses, but the current projection is that the city would make out another bond issuance of $72.5 million in the 2027 fiscal year. The projected annual debt service is about $2.2 million, which would be paid with revenue coming from the water rate increases. The interest cost is projected at 4.8%. The City Council will meet at 6 p.m. Tuesday, May 27th, on the fourth floor of the McLean County Government Center at 115 East Washington Street. Also on the front page, we have Events Honors Those Who Served by Caitlin Klepek. Hundreds gathered Monday morning to watch the annual Memorial Day Parade in downtown Bloomington, making their way toward Miller Park for a ceremony to continue honoring veterans. The parade, which began at 9 a.m. and featured 53 entries, started at the corner of Front and Madison Streets before making its way toward Miller Park for the ceremony. Although organizers could not share a definite answer on how long the VFW Post 454 has put on the parade, archives from the McLean County Museum of History digital files date the annual parade all the way back to the 1930s. "It's been going on as long as I've been alive," organizer Danielle Abrams said with a laugh. Abrams spent multiple years in the Army before moving back home to Bloomington, attending school, and beginning a job in IT. This year marks her third year as organizer for the Bloomington Memorial Day Parade. "It's for memorializing those who died for our freedom," she said before the start of the event. Children and families gathered on the streets to watch the floats and catch candy as it was thrown out. Among those was former Illinois State University basketball player William Tinsley. The former ISU player was accompanied by his sister and his nephews, who are all from McLean County. Tinsley, who attended Ridgeview High School before going on to Illinois State University, said he likes to attend the parade for the family environment. "As you can tell, everybody is coming out from the community. It's good for the community and good for the kids," Tinsley said. Another attendee was Scott Halcomb, joined by his wife, Kathy Halcomb. The couple said they attend the parade every year. "We try to get out, meet people, come out and see the parade when we can," Scott Halcomb said. After the parade, dozens joined as speakers led a ceremony at the Miller Park Bandstand at 1020 South Morris Avenue in Bloomington. The ceremony opened with the Pledge of Allegiance, prayers, scripture readings, and the national anthem. Keynote speaker Jill Henry described her involvement as a woman within the military, as well as other women who serve. History is very familiar with the service and the sacrifice of our servicemen, but I would venture to say that history and the public is not as familiar with the service and sacrifice of our service women, Henry said during her speech. In an interview with the Pantograph prior to the event, Henry said she served in the Army Nurse Corps from 1973 until 1993. As a normal community high school student, Henry first became involved when she was offered a scholarship as a junior through the Walter Reed Army Institute of Nursing. From there, Henry went on to earn a bachelor's and master's degree, aiming to be among the nurses recruited to serve in Vietnam, though upon her graduation, the war had ended. I first was going as kind of a way to get out of town, Henry laughed. But she became more involved than she ever anticipated. She served in various locations from Washington, D.C. to Hawaii and even a deployment to Saudi Arabia in 1991 with the 15th Evacuation Hospital for Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. She later attained the rank of Lieutenant Colonel at retirement. Then, in 2017, she became an Illinois ambassador for the Military Women's Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, where she ensures the stories and livelihood of women veterans remains alive. During her speech, Henry said the Arlington National Cemetery is the only major memorial that honors, remembers, and preserves the stories of women veterans. To date, there have been 179 women who have died while serving, with 11 from Illinois. She cited the service of three local women, the special sheroes, as I call them, Henry said. They are Illinois Army National Guard Specialist Jessica L. Calvey of Normal, who died in 2004 in Iraq at 21 years old. First Lieutenant Deborah A. Banizak of Bloomington, who served in the Missouri National Guard and died in Kuwait in 2005. She was 35. Sergeant Shauna M. Morrison of Champaign, who died in 2004 while serving in Iraq for the Illinois Army National Guard. She was 26. In ending her speech, Henry encouraged all who attended to take a minute of silence at 3 p.m. to think of veterans who have lost their lives. God bless America, the crowd sang in unison. And the third story on the front page is Champaign British Car Festival returns to David Davis Mansion. And that's champagne spelled like the bottle. The Champaign British Car Festival, hosted annually at the David Davis Mansion, brings together car lovers from all over the Midwest. But for local participants, it is more than just the festival. The event is organized by the Illinois Flatland British Car Club, founded in 2005 and open to all interested in talking over dinner with other car folks for what the group calls a natter and noggin. In total, the Illinois Flatland British Car Club has around 150 members, with about 50 active members the group know they can count on for drives. The drives are one more excuse to get in our cars and go for a little ride, Brian Davis said during an interview in his garage last Monday morning. On Mondays, about a dozen members of the group gather for what they call Motoring Monday, which has turned into a group of friends chatting and eating. They call themselves EATS, which stands for Easily Amused Touring Society. During their Monday meetings, attendees draw on the expertise of other members as they plan what to do next with their antique British vehicles. And if you look in the back of Davis's garage door, you'll see a checklist of everything he plans to do to his cars. Nigel Keane, who was born in London but lived in Salisbury, is who the group calls their token English guy. Keane brought his 1980 MGB to Motoring Monday last week. It was a car his father purchased in Maine. The car has been in Illinois since the early 1990s, he said. They're just fun little cars. I'm also working on an MGA, which is the predecessor to the B. It's a 1960, and I've taken it all apart. I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm putting it all back together, Keane laughed. Keane also owns a 1950 MGTD, the oldest car in the group. Member Jim Broach first became interested in British cars when he was 16 years old after he bought an MGA. After he switched to what he called regular cars until his own son was about 14. The father and son duo bought a couple of Spitfires, piecing together parts they had from the two to create one good car. That kind of got me back interested again, Broach said. Since then, he has owned a number of different MGs, Triumphs, and other types of sports cars. The car he brought to last week's Monday get-together is named Mellow Yellow. Another member, Alan Kleinschmidt, said he has been interested in cars since he was around 12. But when he was on R&R from Vietnam and Hawaii, he came across a convertible to drive, and it was an MG. I didn't even know what an MG was, but I rented it for the week, and I fell in love with those little cars, Kleinschmidt said. He bought his first MG in the early 1970s and had various MGs until he started having children. After his children were raised, he began getting back into fixing cars. A little black car he currently has, which he named Black Betty, is a 1980 MGB and has driven all around the country from coast to coast, touching 27 states and even journeying to Canada 3 times in his 16 years of ownership. Kleinschmidt had the car up and running the same afternoon he bought it after it hadn't been driven in 17 years. He compared the car to waking up from a long nap. The more we ran it, the more things came alive in it. It was so funny, he said. I think it's interesting when you look at the age of the folks that are here. We all grew up really more in the muscle car era, 60s, 70s, that sort of thing. But for some reason, the British cars in that era spoke to us, Brian Davis said. One of the nice things about the little British cars is they're affordable, where so many like American muscle cars are not affordable, added Dave Gardner. The Champagne British Car Festival will exhibit between 120 and 150 cars, with a featured marquee. This year, the feature is Jaguar. For next year, the group has already decided Minis will be the feature. Events begin the evening of Friday, May 31st, with a welcome event for travelers at the Chateau Hotel and Conference Center at 1621 Jumer Drive in Bloomington. From there, registration and welcome information will be available, followed by dinner. On Saturday morning, the festival is hosting Cars and Coffee, followed by a car-led scavenger hunt all over McLean County, including on Route 66. Saturday afternoon, the group will hold a boot sale, which is the British name for a trunk, where they are inviting people to bring parts or sell memorabilia. The day will end with a banquet at the Chateau, including a guest speaker, followed by a silent auction for charity. The show will be at David Davis Mansion at 1000 Monroe Drive from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday, June 1st. There will be music, vendors, food and drinks, including fish and chips, and a 1962 double-decker British bus, of course. The Peoria Honor Flight is also bringing over a 1952 MGTD for a raffle, costing $50 a ticket for a chance to win. During the show, patrons can vote for their favorite car to win the People's Choice Award. The winning car gets a trophy. The David Davis Foundation invites the public to come to the festival in exchange for a $5 donation to the foundation. This includes the car show and visiting the mansion or gardens. For more information, visit iflbcc.club. Michael Hawthorne of the Chicago Tribune writes, coal plants exempted from rule. Regulations sought to limit mercury and air pollution. For nearly 4 decades, owners of the Baldwin Power Plant in southern Illinois managed to avoid the most stringent requirements of the Federal Clean Air Act. The gargantuan coal burner, built during the early to mid-1970s, became the nation's largest source of sulfur dioxide, which creates acid rain and lung-damaging soot. It also was among the top emitters of climate-changing carbon dioxide, smog-forming nitrogen oxide, and brain-damaging mercury. After Baldwin's owners kept the Randolph County plant running for years while skipping the installation of modern pollution controls, a 2005 legal settlement with the U.S. Justice Department forced them to begin reducing noxious emissions that contributed to dirty air in Chicago and other downwind cities as far away as New York. Yet, the coal plant remains one of the biggest polluters in the Midwest. By 2020, competition from cleaner, less expensive energy sources prompted the current owner, Houston-based Vistra Corp, to announce it would close Baldwin this year and retire the rest of its Illinois coal fleet by 2027. Now, Vistra is hedging its decisions. In November, the company said it would keep Baldwin running until 2027. Then last month, in an attempt to revive the nation's dwindling coal industry, President Donald Trump threw a lifeline to Vistra and a few dozen other energy companies, encouraging them to apply for exemptions from the latest federal limits on soot, mercury, and other toxic air pollution. Vistra took Trump up on its offer, getting at least a 2-year break from tougher regulations at Baldwin and 6 of its other coal plants, Kincaid south of Springfield, Newton in Jasper County, 3 in Texas, and 1 in Ohio. Howard Lerner, president and CEO of the nonprofit Environmental Law and Policy Center, noted that regulators during the 1970s exempted dozens of coal plants like Baldwin from the toughest provisions of the Clean Air Act after utilities said they wouldn't be running much longer. Decades later, Vistra bought its Illinois coal plants, betting they could still profit from selling their electricity. Like others before them, they're kicking the can down the road to keep running Baldwin and these other plants as long as they can, Lerner said. People in Illinois and other Great Lakes states shouldn't have to suffer the pollution consequences just because President Trump gave them a get-out-of-jail-free card. Others benefiting from Trump's exemptions include NRG's Powerton coal plant near Pekin in Tazewell County, scheduled to close in 2028, and several owned by Southern Company and the Tennessee Valley Authority, two of the biggest energy companies in the Southeast. Executives at Southern and the TVA already are backing off plans to retire coal plants or extending previously announced closure dates. They have told shareholders they are motivated by opportunities to cash in on a projected need for more electricity to power data centers. It is unclear whether the Illinois coal plant owners will follow suit. Vistra and NRG told the Chicago Tribune they plan to adhere to previously announced retirement dates. All told, the 69 coal plants Trump exempted from the mercury and air toxics rule emitted 2,650 pounds of mercury into the atmosphere in 2023, the last year for which federal records are available. The plants accounted for about 10% of all industrial mercury emissions during the period. Just a teaspoon of the toxic metal can contaminate a 20-acre lake. If certain types of fish are a large part of a mother's diet, studies have found mercury passed to her baby in the womb can irreversibly damage the developing brain. The exempted coal plants also are responsible for nearly half of sulfur dioxide emissions and about a third of nitrogen oxide pollution from the nation's electricity generators, according to federal records. Under regulations from former President Joe Biden's administration, now targeted by Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress, the power plants are required to improve the performance of mercury-reducing equipment and in some cases upgrade filters that screen soot from billowing out of smokestacks. The more stringent standards effectively limit emissions of other toxics, including benzene, lead, and arsenic. For the first time, coal plant owners must install equipment to constantly measure mercury emissions, similar to what they already do for carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxide. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimated last year the regulations will provide up to $3 billion in health benefits by 2037, while costing the industry up to $330 million. Republican attempts to roll back the mercury rule and dozens of other environmental regulations come as lower prices for natural gas have prompted many investor-owned companies to abandon coal. Prices for renewable energy have dropped so dramatically that it now costs 45% less to build a new wind farm than operating a coal plant with the same capacity, according to the investment firm Lazard. In other environmental news, we have Carp Prevention Gains Ground by Olivia Olander with the Chicago Tribune. The state of Illinois on Friday finalized its acquisition of a 50-acre piece of land needed for a project to protect the Great Lakes from invasive carp, construction that has drawn the support of both Governor J.B. Pritzker and President Donald Trump. "This is something that we've been waiting for over a decade," Mark Smith, policy director for the National Wildlife Federation, said. "It's very good progress." The state earlier this year postponed construction on the Joliet area project, with state officials saying they didn't want to move forward because they anticipated a federal funding shortfall. Then, 2 weeks ago, the Trump administration announced it supported the project and that funding was available, though Pritzker and Trump still managed to snipe at each other at the time. Midwest Generation, an energy company that had owned the parcel, donated the land after the Illinois Department of Natural Resources approached the company about acquiring the property. Midwest Generation donated the land, quote, "in support of the project," company spokesperson Eric Linden said. Acquiring the land, which includes riverbed access for the Brandon Road lock, will help enable construction at the lock and dam there. The work is intended to stop the spread of invasive carp, which could pose a significant threat to the Great Lakes region's native species, ecosystems, and billion-dollar fishing and boating industries. The property transferred Friday is needed to complete the first part of a three-phase project, according to IDNR spokesperson Jayette Belinsky. Additional upland property will eventually also need to be acquired, Belinsky said. The land transfer that was finalized Friday enables ongoing construction to proceed on schedule, said Don Jodry, director of federal relations at the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Trump, earlier this month, blamed Pritzker for not allowing the project to start, while the federal government, he said, has already begun work on it. The Pritzker administration said it halted the work earlier this year, in part because it was worried needed federal funding wouldn't come through, as the Trump administration had pulled back on unrelated projects. The land had previously been a key sticking point for the project, with some advocates worried it might be contaminated as it's the site of a former coal plant. The agreement reached on the project included assurances that the land will be safe, Smith said. And the Pritzker administration last year said the state negotiated a deal ensuring taxpayers would not have to pay for remediation costs. So-called Asian carp, which are invasive across the United States, include silver, bighead, grass, and black carp. Silver and bighead carp are particular threats to native species as they have no natural predators in American waterways and likely never will, meaning their populations can grow uncontrollably. Invasive carp were introduced in the 1960s to get rid of chemicals in aquaculture and other facilities without using chemicals. But after flooding in the 1980s and 90s, they escaped into the Mississippi River Basin and spread to 31 states. Progress on the project has been a long time coming, Smith said. Congress identified the site as a place to deter invasive species in 2015, according to IDNR. "We've had three presidents, multiple congresses, three governors from Illinois, multiple governors from Michigan, as well as several project managers from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers," he said. "With this property secured, construction can move forward." For your vacation news, we have Airline Updates Battery Rules by Josh Funk with the AP. Passengers on Southwest Airlines flights will soon be required to keep their portable chargers in plain sight while using them because of concerns about the growing number of lithium iron battery fires in a new policy that other airlines may adopt. Southwest announced the new policy that will go into effect May 28th and said passengers may have already seen notifications about the rule when using the airline's app. While Southwest is the first U.S. airline to restrict the use of portable chargers like this, several Asian airlines have taken action earlier this year after a devastating fire aboard an Air Busan plane waiting to take off from an airport in South Korea in January. There is growing concern about lithium iron battery fires on planes because the number of incidents continues to grow yearly, and devices powered by those batteries are ubiquitous. There have already been 19 incidents involving these batteries this year, following last year's record high of 89, according to FAA statistics. The incidents have more than doubled since the pandemic era low of 39 in 2020 and have climbed annually. Some research suggests that portable chargers might be the second leading cause of battery fires on planes, only behind electronic cigarettes. Compared to the roughly 180,000 flights U.S. airlines operate each week, the number of incidents is still relatively small, and lithium batteries can overheat anywhere. However, this is a growing concern for the airlines. It's definitely a serious risk, said David Roth, who studies the risks for UL standards and engagement and works with 37 airlines and battery manufacturers to minimize them. At least a couple of airlines UL is working with are reevaluating the risks associated with rechargeable batteries, so additional rule changes could be coming. In the Korean airline fire in January, all 176 people aboard the plane had to be evacuated because the blaze burned through the plane's roof. The cause of that fire hasn't been officially determined, but several airlines and Korean regulators took action against portable chargers afterwards. Korean Airlines won't allow the chargers to be stored in overhead bins anymore. They must either be packed in a plastic bag or have their ports covered with insulating tape to keep them from touching metal. In addition, Singapore Airlines and Thai Airways both prohibit the use or charging of portable power banks at all during their flights. If your birthday is today, we say happy birthday, and your horoscope reads, you are optimistic and confident, as well as practical, dynamic, and innovative. You understand abstract, intricate theories and can explain them to others. The stars show the kind of day you'll have: dynamic, positive, average, so-so, or difficult. And today, you have 5 stars. And today's Flick Fact: Bloomington Normal will probably never be known as a vacation mecca, but that doesn't mean there aren't Airbnbs, short-term rentals, for guests or tourists to stay in. Do you know how many are registered in the Twin Cities? Well, there are 184 short-term rentals listed online at Airbnb.com, ranging in price from one in Normal for $165 for 5 nights to one in Bloomington that goes for $2,151 for 5 nights. And with that, we conclude reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, May 27, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.